This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. officials say the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and a senior U.S. diplomat in Geneva will announce on Monday that Washington will return to the U.N. Human Rights Council as an observer with an eye toward seeking election as a full member. The decision is likely to draw criticism from conservative lawmakers and many in the pro-Israel community. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the world body's main human rights agency in 2018 due to its disproportionate focus on Israel, which has received by far the largest number of critical council resolutions against any country, as well as a number of authoritarian countries among its members, and because it failed to meet an extensive list of reforms demanded by then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. In addition to the council's persistent focus on Israel, the Trump administration took issue with the body's membership, which currently includes China, Cuba, Eritrea, Russia, and Venezuela, all of which have been accused of human rights abuses. Although the U.S. will have only non-voting observer status on the council through the end of 2021, the official said the administration intends to seek one of three full member seats currently held by Austria, Denmark, and Italy from the Western Europe and other state groups. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's defenders and the U.S. Senate rallied around him on Sunday before his impeachment trial, dismissing it as a waste of time and arguing that the former president's fiery speech before the U.S. Capitol insurrection does not make him responsible for the violence of January 6th. In an interview on ABC's This Week, U.S. Senator Roger Wicker says there may be other options to hold the president or former president accountable.
If being held accountable means being impeached by the House and being convicted by the Senate, the answer to that is no. Now, if there are other ways in the court of public opinion, or if some.
And this is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he will not lift economic sanctions against Iran unless Tehran first cuts its uranium enrichment back to the level it agreed to in a 2015 international treaty aimed at restraining its development of nuclear weapons. Biden said on CBS in an interview that aired Sunday that he wants the U.S. to rejoin the nuclear treaty with Iran that former President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from. But when asked whether the U.S. would lift sanctions first to get Iran to return to negotiations, Biden replied simply no. The Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said on state TV that if the United States wants Iran to return to its commitments, the U.S. must lift all sanctions in practice, then do verification and see if the sanctions were lifted correctly, and then return to the commitments. The pact had allowed Iran to enrich uranium at a 3.67 concentration level, but since mid-2019, it has pushed enrichment levels back up to 20%, the level it had achieved before the accord. Experts say Tehran now has enough low-enriched uranium stockpile for at least two nuclear weapons if it chooses to pursue their manufacture, but Iranian officials, to the long skepticism of Western governments, has long maintained that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. At least nine people are dead. Dozens remain missing in India after part of a glacier in the Himalayas broke off, releasing a torrent of water and debris that slammed into two hydroelectric plants. Experts say the disaster Sunday appears to point to global warming. Video from India's northern state showed the muddy floodwaters tumbling through a valley and surging to a dam, breaking into pieces with little resistance before roaring on downstream. The disaster turned the countryside into what looked like an ash-colored moonscape. Many villages were evacuated, and power plants further downstream were saved by opening up their gates. Hundreds of rescuers were working into the night to find trapped victims. More than 1,000 people gathered in Myanmar's main city on Monday in a new protest against last week's military coup that ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government. The rally drew enthusiastic crowds shouting slogans and holding signs saying no to dictatorship and we want democracy. The demonstrators are seeking to roll back last Monday's seizure of power by the military. They're demanding the release from detention of Suu Kyi, the country's ousted leader, and other top figures from her National League for Democracy party. Monday's protest followed a series of rallies over the weekend. You can find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Can Somalia avert a constitutional crisis today, Monday?
The winner is nobody but the Somali constitution, which has been tortured all along. And this may be a watershed in the future so that any president will take more responsibility in accentuating the implementation of the electoral process.
Uganda's Kizza Besigye breaks silence on recent Ugandan election. What's behind the wave of violence in Kenyan public schools? Amnesty International calls for improvement in Guinea's prisons. And Musa Faki Mahamat is re-elected chair of the African Union Commission.
He got 51 out of 54 votes. That tells you of the kind of quasi-unanimity within the AU for him to continue his journey at that level.
An Angolan cartoonist wins the European Union Human Rights and the Rule of Law Award. And Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono is also a rapper. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Somalia faces a constitutional crisis today, Monday, after President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo and leaders from two of the country's five semi-autonomous regions, Puntland and Jubaland, did not agree over the weekend on when to hold elections. Faiza Abdul Roble is a Somali analyst.
I think we expect two scenarios. The most prominent scenario at this point in time is for the Speaker of the House, Master Mursal, to assume the power for a limited period of time, which has yet to be identified, 3 months to 6 months to complete the election process. The other scenario, which we don't know whether it would be acceptable to the president, is for the president himself to resign voluntarily so that there's no constitutional crisis to be created.
I did speak with someone before, I think or last week, who described the uptake in the recent violence and tried to link it to political instability. What would this mean in case this constitutional process is not resolved in terms of stability of Somalia?
It would be a very dangerous situation. First of all, the groups that are vying for the power, for the presidency, are all from Mogadishu. They are indigenous to the capital. Therefore, the mass support they have could be really a factor in demonstrations. And with demonstrations, there may be also an erosion of security. As you know, a prominent general from Mogadishu himself, who is related to some of the candidates, was also killed by Al-Shabaab, supposedly, which really created a lot of schism in the city as to why the general was killed at this point in time in the history of the election process. So any mishap that takes place between the president, whose time is expired, and the candidates, potential candidates, who all are from the Mogadishu region, could really create a security gap. And that's the fear most Somalis are today discussing.
So let's assume that President Mohamed is forced to resign. Who wins in this dispute?
The winner is nobody but the Somali constitution, which has been tortured all along. And this may be a watershed in the future so that any president who comes there as a result of election would adhere to the time and will take more responsibility in accentuating the implementation of the electoral process, which they have not done so far. So this time, people are not looking at who is going to replace him. People are looking at the supremacy and president of the constitution.
Thank you so much, sir. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
That was Faiza Abdi Roble, a Somali analyst, speaking with us. In Uganda, the former presidential candidate of the Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC, Dr. Kizza Besigye, has broken silence on the conduct of the January 14 presidential election. Dr. Besigye, who contested for the presidency four different times, says this year's election was no different from previous elections.
Well, the election, I think, has played out pretty much along the same template that it has done in the previous elections. And that is that really it's very much just going through the motion, because all the institutions of state that moderate political processes are totally captured by Mr. Museveni, and he at the end of the day really is more or less the one who announces himself as the winner.
As you know, Dr. Besigye, the Honorable Bobby Wine and his party have filed now a petition with the Supreme Court of Uganda. Anytime people hear about an election court petition, they always make reference to you as someone who have been there before. What are your expectations?
Well, again, I petitioned the outcome of the elections that I've participated in, four presidential elections. I petitioned the outcome on two occasions, on two successive elections of 2001 and 2006. The outcome was exactly the same, with the court divided in the center. In 2001, three out of five judges voting to uphold the election, and in 2006, 4-3 in favor of maintaining the outcome of that election. And that is in spite of the fact that in both petitions, all the judges, undivided, confirmed the grounds of our petition, that the election was not conducted in accordance with the law, that there were many malpractices. But there is an interesting provision in the Presidential Elections Act that gives each judge a subjective discretion to determine whether all those things that have been found affected the outcome of the election in a substantial manner. And substantial is a matter that has been very debated, what substantial means. Nonetheless, I am in support of those who go to petition, in spite of the judiciary, just like all other state institutions, being captured, being really run by Mr. Museveni as his walking stick.
Dr. Besigye, since the January 14 election, I had the opportunity to speak with the Honorable Bobby Wine twice. And every time we speak, he will say that he's calling on the international community to at least do something about the way the conduct of the election and democracy in Uganda. You have been quoted by the local media, I think, making a comment on the Honorable Bobby Wine's meeting with a delegation from the European Union. And the media, the local media, suggesting perhaps there's a difference in the way you see the role of the international community. What is the truth?
First of all, I actually give credit to the European Union, especially for playing a positive role in observation of elections in Uganda. They have been, I think, the most comprehensive election observers in Uganda. Whereas I am grateful for that positive role that they have played in, my comment on them was that this would be greatly enhanced, and I would appreciate if, having seen indeed that there is absolutely no will on the part of the Museveni junta to either pay attention to the recommendations that they have made, or indeed to take the country in any other way forward in terms of the democratization, I would have expected that they would now take some actions rather than just making statements, that they would take some actions that would back their statements.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is the former presidential candidate of the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC Party of Uganda. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. African leaders meeting over the weekend have re-elected Moussa Faki Mahamat as chair of the African Union Commission. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Khan says the margin of Mahamat's victory is an indication of his popularity.
I think first, the result itself is quite very impressive. He got 51 out of 54 votes, and he was the only candidate and was elected for at the first round. That tells you of the kind of quasi-unanimity within the AU for him to continue his journey at that level. And I believe that this quasi-unanimity is related to a number of successes during his first term. For example, the way the AU, through the African CDC, handled the COVID-19 issue on the continent, helping member states to have a coordination, to buy all the material together, and to really advise a member state on the way to deal with the virus, the pandemic. I also think that FACI helped in many situations, not to solve the situation, but at least to make sure that the different actors are talking to each other in the different conflicts. Remember the issue of the dam between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt started to be dealt with by the U.S., but FACI managed to bring back the issue at the continental level and ask the AU chairperson to start dealing with it. The problem is not sorted out, but at least it's African countries that are trying to deal with African issues.
Of course, the challenges of the coronavirus and democracy issues still loom on the African continent.
When you look at democratic issues on the continent, that's where you start asking yourself if he really played an important role. For example, up to now, the report of the election monitoring in Tanzania was not adopted by the AU Commission, people who went to monitor the election. We all know what happened during the election in Uganda. The AU didn't really put its weight on the issues, trying at least to play an important role in that election that ended up in violence and everything. And the most difficult one is the crisis in Ethiopia. You know, Ethiopia is the seat of the AU headquarters. He didn't do a lot in trying to deal with the Tigrayan issues, which is not only an Ethiopian problem, but it's a problem that was internationalized, including Eritrea, including Sudan. The AU should have done better in that regard.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Monday, February 8th. Kenyan public schools have been experiencing a wave of school unrest and growing cases of arson, with dormitories being the main targets. At least 25 boarding schools have been set ablaze since January 4th this year, when schools reopened after closing for 10 months due to the coronavirus pandemic. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the government says it will start arresting and prosecuting any students found plotting and executing arson in schools.
Education Chief Administrative Secretary Zaki Nudhia says the government will no longer condone such unruly behaviors in schools across the country that have resulted in the loss of property worth millions of shillings.
We shall treat you as a criminal and we shall take you through the procedure a criminal is undertaken by putting you in cell, taking you to court, and jailing you through the courts because of your behavior. Because you cannot bring down millions of worth investment and let you scot-free. And this government is both your government and the government of the parents you are impoverishing by burning down the property. And we shall take very stern action against you. I am calling you to forthwith cease your behavior.
Police spokesperson Charles Owino also warned that the criminal records of those that would be found responsible would be used against them for the rest of their adult lives.
We need to remind the boys and girls that have started burnings and maliciously destroying school properties that all persons aged 8 years and above are criminally liable for any criminal acts or omissions that they commit. They have a criminal responsibility as long as you are 8 years and above. Upon prosecution, your criminal records shall be kept by the Criminal Records Office at the DCI for the rest of your life. This will definitely affect your future career prospects.
However, Kenya National Union of Teachers Secretary General Wilson Soshion says one way to deal with the wave of unrest in public schools is to completely abolish boarding schools. He says this would enable parents to regain their parenting skills and teachers to focus on students' academics.
And I think it is time in this country that we abolish boarding schools completely and we make our public schools, day schools, quality and state of the art so that parents can take care of children after 5 o'clock and bring them to us on the next day at 8 o'clock.
Kisumu Boys High School is one of the schools that has recently experienced an arson attack where a dormitory was razed to the ground and property worth hundreds of thousands destroyed. This teacher from the school, who prefers to be anonymous, told VOA that students were responsible for the arson. He blames the behavior on the long stay at home during the COVID period and the fact that the learners are still struggling to adjust to the school routine. On the other hand, Cabinet Secretary for Education, Professor George Magoha, says that teachers will also be held responsible for any fires at their schools because they have the mandate to prevent such behavior from happening. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
An Angolan cartoonist is the winner of this year's European Union's Franco-German Human Rights and Rule of Law Award for his commitment to the promotion of freedom of expression in Angola. Sergio Pissarra tells me the award will serve as a motivation for him to do more.
Yeah, I'm very happy about that. I wouldn't expect receiving this prize. It's a great honor. It gives me, strength. To go forward, the good strength for all the people who fight for the human rights and the freedom of expression in Angola. So I'm very happy about that.
What do you think about human rights in Angola?
Yeah, we still have lots of problems here in terms of human rights. We're living in circles. Sometimes you need things are improving. Since João Lourenço took office 2 or 3 years ago, yeah, we always expected things start being better. In this particular, but we're having once in a while very serious problems in terms of human rights. Some days ago, after the very serious problems happened in the east of Angola, in the diamond production area, where the police, they killed several people who supposedly were having a protest for something that they fight for. Sometimes they just repress protests here in Luanda. We're having problems here in Luanda with the police killing protesters more than once.
You are a cartoonist, and how do you think your work as a cartoonist contributes to the fight for human rights and freedom of speech in Angola?
I think in a way it helps. At least people say that, that my work has been helping freedom of speech and human rights in general in Angola. And I agree. I think we should have more cartoonists here. I'm almost the only one guy drawing cartoons, political cartoons in this way. So somehow I think being cartoonists, it's been helping denouncing and making through the humor, you can have find some ways, some subtle ways of denouncing situations that can eventually help the freedom of speech and human rights in general.
Sergio, let me say congratulations again for the award. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Sergio Pissarra is an Angolan cartoonist. He was speaking with us from the capital, Luanda. Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono has been making headlines for his multiple arrests, triggered last year by his social media posts highlighting government corruption. Now, just recently released on bail for yet another alleged violation, Chigono is making fresh headlines, this time for rapping. His tweet, rapping a reggae beat on the level of looting by Zimbabwean government officials and members of the ruling ZANU-PF party, has set yet another local Twitter record for the award-winning journalist. Chigono spoke with VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Gibbs Dube about his song, Damn Loot.
It was never put out as a piece of journalism. This was just hope of the citizen who was... I was in my study, where I'm sitting right now. I was reading, and I got bored, and I started reflecting, as I had been doing when I was in prison, about conversations I was having with so many youths last year when I was accusing them of not participating in political, economic, and social issues that affect their day-to-day lives. And then I decided to say, a lot of our youth in Zimbabwe, they listen to reggae music. Let me try and just do something talking about the issues that I encourage them to engage with on a day-to-day basis and see how they will react. So that's what I did. And then when I put it out, it went viral. It was never a form of journalism. It was just me as a citizen, just interacting with the youths and using a language and art form that they are more comfortable with.
But as a journalist, is this not toxic in terms of your writing? Because when you look at fairness and impartiality, it means you're wearing a jacket of a journalist every hour, every minute, every second. So does this not discredit you somehow?
No, it doesn't discredit me. Newspapers have editorials. They comment on issues that affect citizens that they're covering. Television stations have talk shows, like the one that we're having at the moment. People are expressing opinion. And what I did with that song, I was expressing opinion and fact, because it is a fact, and I've proved it, that money is being looted. So I was just saying what I say every day when I write newspaper columns for international newspapers like the New York Times or the Guardian, or when I'm reporting for the BBC. I was just doing it using an art form that I knew would be more receptive. The youth would be more receptive to it if I used that art form. It could have been, the words that I used in that song could have been in an article in the New York Times. So I just see it as a different platform that I used, but otherwise, there's no difference.
Hopewell Chigono is a Zimbabwean investigative journalist. You are speaking with Viewer Zimbabwe Service reporter Gift Dube. Time now for Daybreak Africa's Post. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Total African Nations Championship CHAN, which began 3 weeks ago but was concluded on Sunday. Defending champion Morocco won the 2020 CHAN tournament, designed exclusively for players plying the trade in their domestic league for the second time, by overcoming Mali's Bowl Challenge 2-0 in a thrilling final at the Amadou Hayijo Stadium in Yaoundé on Sunday night. Two second-half headers by Abdul Mouna Boutelli and Captain Ayoub El Kabi sealed a victory for the Atlas Lions in the tournament in Cameroon to hand them the title. Andre Mirabu Mahoup is a journalist with Canal 2 Television in Cameroon, and Benin Boumagouma is a Cameroonian sports football commentator. They both described the performance of the North Africans as deserving of a champion.
I think very, very much that they worked really very, very hard to have gotten to this state of the championship and to have lifted the trophy. It is a great work that the Moroccan team put up.
In this edition, there was Morocco and the other teams. Morocco was well prepared, and you can just see the score. They beat Cameroon in the semi-final 4-0. Now they are in the 12 games in championship, Africa championship, without defeat. Two editions without a single defeat.
Having covered the tournament for 3 weeks, I asked both journalists to describe what stood out for them during this competition.
For me, the main success of this edition of African Championship is the organization and the courage of CAF and COCAN Cameroon to organize a competition during a health crisis.
What stood out for me during this tournament, and I think I really appreciate it right to the end, is first of all the turnout not only of the teams but the supporters of the teams.
Away from the CHAN tournament now to the FIFA Club World Cup, where Al Ahly of Egypt are representing the African continent at the FIFA Club World Cup. Head coach Peter Masumani said it will be a wonderful story for his side to secure victory over FIFA Club World Cup favourites and European champions Bayern Munich in Monday's semi-final in Al Rayyan.
We just have to work on the anxiety of the players, and they must do what they always do. We must never change and do new things because we play in Bayern. We do exactly what brought us here and exactly what made us to win the last game, and that's we're best. If we give our best and our best is not good enough, then we have given everything.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, February 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you